Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
Discover the power within. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Fort Worth in Texas. And today we begin a new four-part series on the theme of finding meaning. And so we kick it off with a discussion with author and activist Justin Miller. Justin is the co-author of the book Beyond Blood, Hope and Humanity in the Forgotten Fight Against AIDS. He's a graduate of Vanderbilt University, and he's also the co-founder of Care for AIDS, which operates now in 61 centers in communities across Kenya and Tanzania. I think there's one in Uganda now, so he'll tell us more about that. And those areas have been the hardest hit in some ways by HIV/AIDS, so a very important topic, of course. So it's a pleasure to welcome Justin to today's show. Glad you're with us.
Thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. And you're coming to us from Atlanta, right? That's where you're based.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's just jump in the deep end. I just finished your book, and a fascinating book, very well written. And you co-authored it with Justin and Cornell, right, who are two Kenyans who partnered with you in some of the work that you're doing in that country and in Tanzania as well. So I think I got an idea from the book how you got interested in this. But fill the story in for our listeners.
Yes. Well, Cornell and Duncan have been with me since the very beginning. And I guess it's probably more accurate to say that I partnered with them because they were already doing this work before I even stepped foot on the African continent. But right. About 2006, I got introduced to the epidemic through an unlikely source. But Bono of the band U2 was the conduit by which I learned about HIV and AIDS and realized that I needed to answer this big question that he posed, which is, what is the church going to do about it? And I set off on this journey to learn more about HIV, an issue that at the age of 18, I really had no exposure to or understanding of. And I found myself 9 months later on the ground in Kenya with a video camera and a few of my buddies, and we were going to do a documentary about HIV and AIDS. And the people that met us when we got off the plane were none other than Cornell and Duncan. And as we just discovered the realities of HIV and the atrocities that were resulting because of that, we decided to form a partnership together with these two Kenyan leaders. And that partnership has now stood the test of time for the past 12 years. And a lot of lives in East Africa have been impacted as a result of it.
So you were at a Christian conference, right, in San Diego, I think you said, and when Bono showed up on the screen, right, he wasn't there in the flesh, but he left a video. And, of course, back at that time, Bono was very involved, wasn't he, in work in Africa, and we heard about that in the news a lot, you know, that he was an advocate for that. So you were right there listening to that at the time. And he's a very impassioned speaker, isn't he? The times I've been to his concerts, he always stops his concert in the middle and starts talking about some kind of social activism. And in this case, it was HIV/AIDS and other problems that sub-Saharan Africa is, you know, suffering from. So, yeah, interesting. And, of course, you'd been to that part of the world just a few months prior to that, right? Because you climbed Kilimanjaro. So you'd already been to to that continent, right? So that was kind of interesting.
That is interesting. My dad had done some work in Africa in his past, and he knew from when I was a young kid that he said, one day I've got to take Justin to Africa, because it'll just change his life and his world. Mm-hmm. And so he had taken me. I saw a very different part of Africa on the trip to do Kilimanjaro. So when I went back, it was a whole other side of the continent that I had not seen before.
Well, and I'm sure that's true. You know, there's the sort of the safari and the trekking kind of side of it, isn't there? You know, for fairly wealthy Westerners, and then there's the real life in the ordinary villages, you know, that can be starkly contrasting to that. I interesting though that you were there, because you know there's a taste of it, even though it wasn't exactly the same. And also I was interested in you say that, you know, you'd applied for all these Ivy League schools or these high flying universities, and ended up at Vanderbilt, which in itself is a very high level university, but not the one you really wanted to go to at the time. But then you spent 4 years there, and you know it was the best education you could have hoped for, right? And I love that, because God takes us places where, you know, we don't always think we're supposed to go, right? And we just have to trust the process sometimes. And I'm assuming that's where you met your current wife too, was it, at Vanderbilt? And
she's
from Fort Worth, isn't she?
Fort Worth girl, yes.
Yeah. All right. Very good.
Yeah. It is interesting how God takes his. I was fighting my way trying to get these other schools, and God brought me to Vanderbilt, where I met my wife, and he developed the idea of Care for AIDS. And some of my early partners were some of my friends that came out of that school with me. And so it taught me very early that, you know, our plans are not always the best plans, and God may have something for us that's better if we trust him.
Right. We have to listen. We have to pay attention. Yeah. So tell us about the other two folks that you said were, you know, crucially important in this initiative that you've got, Cornell and Duncan. They speak very eloquently in the book about their childhood and education and whatnot. And some of it wasn't necessarily much fun. You know, there was a lot of beatings and stuff that struck me as, pretty harsh. But they both came forward from that, you know, very dedicated. One's a pastor now, right? And his, the other one had a dad who was a pastor. Is that right? Am I correct?
Right. Yes. Yeah. Cornell is a pastor by training, and still preaches from time to time. But both of them are engaged full time with Care for AIDS, and so that's their main focus. But Cornell always talks about how it was hard for him to let go of this idea that he was supposed to be in a physical church building leading a congregation. That's what he always was going to be doing. But now he said, you know, my church is now thousands of people spanning the region. I never thought that I'd get to have such a wide congregation across the
region. Right.
These guys and you may want to talk about this, but I think one of the fascinating things about Cornell and Duncan is that they are from radically opposing tribes in their country. And that was part of there's just something very interesting about the timing of this whole thing happening with Care for AIDS, because while we were launching our very first program, the country was erupting in violence after the 2007 elections. And the next month, we were launching our first center, and Cornell is literally in hiding because he is fearful for his life as we're off this program that's being that was initiated by two guys from these opposing tribes. And so it's a beautiful picture of reconciliation and building these connections across very tumultuous boundaries.
And one's, you'll have to remind me, but one's Kikuyu, is that right? And the other one is?
Is Luo.
Luo. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And the Luo is what I read in the book, is sort of centered around Lake Victoria, right, in that area. And wasn't Jomo Kenyatta, who became the first leader after independence, he was a Kikuyu, wasn't he? Is that right?
Yes. That's right. Yeah. His son Uhuru is now the president of Kenya.
Right.
So
that ethnic group is still kind of dominant in the country, or?
They have held a lot of the power over the last 50 years. The Luo tribe has been the ones that have been constantly opposing that.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, luckily Kenya isn't as full of strife as some African countries, right? There's been worse atrocities in, you know, in other states nearby. I mean, Uganda has had its rough times. I don't think Kenya's had anywhere near that. It's still pretty tough, though, but not genocide or whatever. So
no, it's been one of the more stable countries in the region. It's, you know, the sad part is they're positioned so well to succeed as a country and develop, but I think corruption is still at the root of what is keeping Kenya from like realizing its full potential.
Right.
That's the biggest thing you have to overcome, which is it's not on the front page like, you know, genocide or this kind of civil wars that are going on, but it is something that is definitely hurting Kenya.
So the theme I got for the month is different shows looking at, you know, the idea of finding meaning, right? And we've got a variety of what that means for people. But so what does it mean for you, you know, finding meaning? Why did you choose this particular outlet for your talents and your focus? Why was it so meaningful? Because you could have done a multitude of other things that weren't necessarily as tough as this. This is a pretty tough one you've taken on, right?
Yeah, well, I think there's two things I would say. I heard someone speak recently, and she said, you know, she would say, I don't think you can find your purpose. I think you can build it, though. And I think that is a part of what I've been able to do at Care for AIDS. Because in the beginning, I mean, this was a summer project that a couple buddies of mine did, and I had my career aspirations were not anywhere in this ballpark at all. And now I'm so deeply passionate about the work in East Africa. I'm deeply passionate about nonprofits and helping them to raise money effectively, to do work effectively in the field. And so my passion for this has only been developed and cultivated over the time that I've been doing it. But I also just think that I didn't realize at the time, but there's just this connection between your, you know, whatever it is that God has given you in terms of your skills and abilities and the passions that he's put in you and the opportunities that come your way. And it's sometimes hard to find the intersection of those, but I was blessed to be able to find that at a very young age, where I realized that God's given me a passion for organizations and leadership. And my studies were in that field in undergrad. I also have a passion for helping people, and really started, part of the passion of Care for AIDS grew out of wanting to help Cornell and Duncan create an organization that could serve their own people. And the opportunity to do this was, you know, I'm thankful I didn't miss it, but it came in my path at a young age. So for me, when I felt like this, the convergence of my passions, my skills, and the opportunities that God put in front of me aligned in Care for AIDS, I mean, that to me is where I found that perfect alignment.
Right. Yeah. Great. Well, you brought up non-profit organizations, you know, and sometimes there's been some bad publicity around NGOs, you know, non-government organizations, and some, you know, the compromises that have to be made, even the corruption of some of them, unfortunately. And I know yours is church-based, right? All the 61 centers that you have are in local churches throughout the country there. So tell us, how does that work exactly? The structure.
So we have, you know, for those listening, our purpose as an organization is to empower people to live a life beyond AIDS. And we realized very, very early on that there were some gaps in the services that were being provided to men and women living with HIV and AIDS. One, they were exclusively medical. There wasn't a lot of social services that were being provided. A lot of the care from the NGO community is being focused on children and not families. And we believe, we just saw, and the church was pretty quiet on the issue. Some churches were very outspoken against people with HIV, and others that wanted to be for that community didn't have the resources or the knowledge to know how to care for them well. So we saw an opportunity to work through these local churches to provide a program that would address the needs of this community very holistically and really focus on parents specifically to affect the future of the family and to keep these kids in homes, as opposed to having their mom or dad or both pass away and leaving these kids to be orphans. So our program in this local church, every local church we partner with has 80 clients at a time who are in a cohort there. And we have two full-time staff that help address their physical needs, spiritual needs, emotional, social, and economic needs, so that when they leave our program, they're a fully transformed and empowered individual who can continue to live beyond the program that we have.
Right. So you're offering a holistic approach. It's not just in one area. You're trying to build a whole person, right, and equip them in many areas. So yeah, I think this is powerful. Mm-hmm. But, you know, coming back to the church, you know, sometimes, well, I don't know about evangelical churches today so much, but I know there was some, as you alluded to, there was some resistance, right, to even being in support of HIV/AIDS at one time, you know, because it was seen as, well, for, I don't want to second guess why, but there, and that's what Bono was saying, presumably, you know, listen, guys, you need to step up here. You're not doing enough work in that regard.
Yeah.
Has that changed today? I mean, is there a similar reticence there, or is it the new attitude?
Well, let me speak to the American church and the African church.
Right.
When I was in that conference with Bono 13 years ago, he quoted a stat that only 6% of the American church felt that it was incumbent upon them to do anything about HIV and AIDS. I'm afraid the attitudes are probably not that much different today than they were, but for maybe for different reasons. I think some people still perceive it as obviously a moral hazard to wade into, but I also think that many people just don't have an awareness of what the state of HIV is in the world today. So they're probably pretty ignorant on what's actually happening with HIV. In East Africa, I have seen a shift, and I can speak to Kenya specifically because we've been there the longest. I just remember in the early days, we were hard pressed to find a single church that would want to have a program like this in their church, because not only would that potentially tarnish their reputation in the community, but they thought, man, inviting sick people into our church is only going to create a greater financial burden on our community that we can't withstand. And then over time, you've seen these ideas change and evolve, and people realize that, man, once they get the right help, these are vibrant community members, church members who are actually going to be contributing to your community in a lot of different ways. And so the openness of the church, I mean, we have more churches that want to partner with us than we could ever work with. And they're waiting to say, hey, we want this program in our church, which is not the attitude they had 10 years ago.
Right. That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
But there is this sense that it's a sin or whatever, that they, like you say, a moral failing or whatever. And this isn't always true today, of course, because there's many reasons why people get HIV/AIDS, not just for homosexual choices or whatever. And there's been some pushback in that regard, too, in some evangelical churches, right, that, you know, homosexuality is a sin or whatever, and, you know. And so we don't want to address the problems. But of course, it's a lot more than just, homosexuality, right? We're talking about all kinds of drug use, and children with no fault of their own, you know, getting it because of other choices that have been made. So, you know, this is a huge thing. It's, you can't just label it in one area, right?
No, it's very complex. And that's why if there are people that are living in lifestyles that are going to bring harm to them and their family, I try to encourage them into a new way. But we don't not discriminate on anybody that comes into our program, whether they were they received it by no fault of their own, or they were the ones that that made choices like that. And so for us, everybody we believe is more than just their HIV status, and we want to help them realize their value and their worth. And so that's for us, we pay attention to it because we want to look at what are the contributing factors to the continued spread of HIV. But in terms of selecting people to serve, that's not a criteria we look at.
Right, exactly. And, you know, Jesus himself said that, you know, what you did for the least of these, you did for me, right? So you know, invited us to love everyone regardless. So we, if we get back to the real, you know, the teaching, the actual teachings of Jesus, right? So
yeah.
Sometimes the ecclesiastical history is clouded over some of what Jesus said, you know, and it's nice to get back to his actual words sometimes, which are quite radical, right? I mean, he was there with lepers, which was the sort of HIV/AIDS of his time, probably, and you know, was willing to go into situations that, you know, a lot wouldn't. So you know, we have to follow the master here, and you know, so if it's good enough for Jesus, seems like it should be, you know, good enough for us. So commend you in your willingness to do that. To do that work. So tell us about the program itself. I heard there's a 9-month program, or what? Well, tell us about that.
Yeah. So the only thing I'll add to that is we've mainly been working in urban context for the past 10, 12 years. We now have a new variation of our model that we're experimenting with in rural areas, which is actually an 18 month. But in the urban context, it's 9 months. People are recruited in based on the highest level of vulnerability, as we best judge that by their viral load, their age, their number of dependents. And so we look at that, we admit them into the program, and then they will have interactions with our staff on average about 2 times per week. So either they're coming to the church or we're going to their home and engaging them in activities like one-on-one counseling, group therapy, which is vitally important as you get 15 to 20 of these individuals together and they start counseling one another and sharing advice and how they've walked through some difficult situations. And we have a big focus on economic empowerment. Obviously, this is a ultra poor group of people and they need to be able to start some kind of income generating activity to be able to provide just the basic necessities for their family and hopefully to be able to send their kids to school. And then we also, as I said, visit them in their home once a month to continue that counseling, but also to observe their living conditions and consult with them on hygiene and nutrition and things like that. So we provide all of our clients a regular portion of nutrition to help as they try to suppress the viral load in their body, which is something that nutrition is critically important to be paired with the medication. So it's, as I said, it's our best attempt at helping address this from all of the many factors that are pushing on people with HIV. With all of these interventions, if you leave out a couple of these, it leaves the door open for that person to end up kind of spiraling back into a place of emotional despair and hopelessness, but also physical sickness as well.
Right. So how is the program funded?
We are funded 100% through private donors in the U.S. and churches that partner with us. Those are the individuals and the families and the churches that support our work.
So is that a big part of your work over here in the States to fundraise, or are you involved with other areas from Atlanta?
That's a big part of it. There's about 8 people that are full-time that are based in the Southeast who are helping us with our U.S. fundraising and developing partnerships and things like that. And then I have a pretty big role in helping to support our African leadership team as well, but I'd say fundraising is what gets the majority of my attention.
Right. So how often do you actually go over there to Africa?
Well, you know, it's usually been about 3 times per year. And oftentimes I'm there to either just work with our leadership team there, but also to take donors over to get to experience the work there firsthand.
Right. To get feet on the ground and see what it's really like, right? Because that can make a difference, can't it, in our commitment to something when we actually see it face to face. You know, it's one thing to hear about it or to see it in pictures, but when you're actually there on the ground, it can be quite impactful, can't it?
Yes, it can, and it obviously helps them come back and be able to advocate for our work in a more personal way. But I think it also just it impacts people spiritually in a profound way as they get to meet people who, by our standards, have nothing materially but seem to be rooted in such joy despite circumstances. And that's just, for some people, that's the biggest takeaway, is they just have a real spiritual experience once they're there.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that I've traveled in the third world quite a bit myself. And I would say that is a characteristic, you know, that they may be, quote, dirt poor in our Western terms, but and yet there's still that sense of joy and a living life to the full, which in some ways we've lost here in the West, you know, that we're surrounded by all the money we could ever possibly spend or the goods we could ever possibly buy, and yet it doesn't necessarily bring us happiness, right? And we see, you know, the examples of that every day, you know, people very upset or even committing suicide, you know, they've made it in Hollywood, but they're still not happy, whatever. So, you know, there's some things we can learn. It's the old system was, you know, we were the patriarchs looking down on these, you know, it was a colonialist attitude.
Right.
But hopefully, you know, we've moved beyond that, right? And then we're partnering with these people because they are, you know, integral and valuable people. And I think that's what comes across, actually, in the book is the chapters you know, that were written by the other folks that you co-authored with, you know, were very compelling and then very well written. And of course, they could have all been edited. I don't know. But they were obviously, you know, very thoughtful, sensitive people and very compelling writing. So, you know, this is a testimony. So I'm glad that, you know, you didn't just write the book from your own perspective, you know, Western perspective, you've included these folks as well, which makes it a more powerful statement, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that was my hope is that started going into this writing process and even this whole journey. I mean, I think the thought was, well, you know, I'm the American and I'm here to help,
right,
which is kind of a cool perspective, but you get into it and you realize 10 years down the road that these guys have impacted me in my life in far greater ways than I've ever done for them.
Right.
So it's really...
I hear the music, Justin. We're going to need to take a break. We're at the break, folks. Listen to these messages from Unity, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes to talk with Justin Miller about all the work that he's doing in Africa. Join us then.
Practical spirituality. Positive messages. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Justin Miller. He's the co-founder of Care for AIDS, which works with HIV and AIDS-related problems in Africa, particularly Kenya and Tanzania. And we've been talking about how he found meaning in that work, and a little bit about his book called Beyond Blood, which I recommend you read. It's a very fascinating book, which gives the background to what he's doing with Care for AIDS. And so we're back to talk about where are we in the world today with AIDS. I mean, you just shared at the break that there's a program that was being tested in a new vaccine, right, which had to be postponed or canceled even. Tell us about that. What's going on?
Yeah, well, you know, some people may not know that there's still upwards of 2 million new infections a year, which is down from the peak of the epidemic, but it's still very much an alarming number, and anywhere from 800 to a million HIV-related deaths every year. So we still feel like that is, you know, that's unacceptable, and we still have so much more that we need to do in this area. But there has been hope of a vaccine on the horizon, and this is not necessarily the area of the epidemic that I'm working closely in, but they did have a trial that was going on, a human trial in South Africa, that has just been discontinued because those in the trial, there showed no significant variation in new infections between those that were given the actual drug and those that were given the placebo. And so that was one of them. I think in some ways it is a setback. Obviously we have learned a little bit more about what is needed in the vaccine. So not sure what the future of treatment holds. I hope that one day Care for AIDS doesn't need to exist, because either figure out a cure or a vaccine, but for the time being, we're going to have to just keep focusing on how do we help slow the advancement of HIV by caring for those that have it so they don't transmit it to any of their spouses or partners or their children.
In the right. Family. And of course, unfortunately, you know, our attention span is short, isn't it? And what was the big epidemic, you know, yesterday, then, you know, falls off the screen, and we got others to worry about. You know, right now, of course, it's the coronavirus is taking a lot of people's attention. And if not that, it's SARS or, you know, Ebola or Lassa fever, whatever. You know, there's all these things that the media puts out there to sort of, I'm not saying they're not real, they are real, but sometimes we get misinformation about them or it's blown out of proportion, etc. And then other things that are equally, you know, serious get put on the back burner. So, you know, it's I know a lot of people don't talk about HIV/AIDS anymore because it's like, oh, well, you know, that was then, you know, but we forget, like you said, that's salutary to know that there's that many, you know, cases a year and that many deaths a year, which is, you know, still a very large problem in our world. And particularly in, you know, like you said, the third world in Africa and other third world places, you know, that have the least ability to cope with this, too. You know, they don't have the sophistication of the infrastructure, number one. And so you're providing that for them. Shifting gears a little bit, let's talk about what you've learned in terms of leadership. You know, you're a young man, right? I'm assuming you're still in your early 30s, right? You must be if you were.
That's correct.
You listened to Bono, what, 13 years ago, and you were 18. Yeah, so you're still. I could call you a young man. By my standards, very. but so you still got a whole lot of life ahead of you, and God willing. And so, you know, what have you learned so far? You know, because you've been thrust into, you know, a fairly high level of leadership responsibility. Yeah. So tell us about that. How does that work, especially for people of your own age who may be considering this kind of taking leadership, and not necessarily in HIV/AIDS, but in any leadership situation?
Yeah, well, I think there's so much I could share in this arena. I think,
yeah,
as a young person, there was a sense of, you know, ambition that we had to try to grow, to do things. But I think, you know, this whole thing has obviously taught me, like, in spades, just to have, you know, more and more humility as a leader. That is one of the characteristics of the best leaders, is that they have this humility. And I hope I have it. I still am trying to understand. I think the more that you learn, obviously, the more you realize what you don't know. And as the organization has grown, in terms of now having over 200 staff, at every turn, there are new leadership challenges that I've had to be faced with. So I've learned how to go from doing the work myself of leading the team of one here in the U.S. to how do we build high-performance leadership teams, and how to focus on helping others grow and develop, which is an area that was really a challenging thing for me, was to try to help understand. I knew how to help myself grow, but it's hard to help other people grow. And, you know, just there have been a host of leadership lessons, but especially when it comes to cross-cultural leadership too, I don't want to be that that paternalistic figure who's coming in and saying, well, I have the money, so I am going to set the agenda. I have to really submit to the to my co-founders and work really well with the national leadership there, so that we can meet the needs of donors and what they're expecting from us over here. But at the end of the day, we can stay focused on what is the highest good for our clients on the ground.
Right. Some people, you know, when they hear it's a church-based organization, whatever, they got concerns that there's going to be a lot of proselytizing, you know, bringing people home to Jesus, etc. And not that there's anything inherently wrong with that, but it's the sense that, well, we're doing this, you know, work that's humanitarian work, but we have an ulterior motive to bring souls back to, you know, to the church, to Jesus. So how would you approach that? Because maybe that's an old style way of thinking, you know, for a lot of organizations working missions working in the third world, you know, that was a big part of what they're doing. Not to say they didn't do good work, but how, as a young person, as a millennial, how do you approach that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think I hold both of those motives we hold them in tension with one another, but I believe, and this is not something that the generations of the church before us really focused on a lot, but I believe part of our mandate in Scripture is to help to bring healing and restoration to the things that are broken in this world, and to care about people's current realities as well as their future eternal realities. So we do not shy away when asked to talk about our faith and our beliefs, what we believe, and inviting people, if they want to follow Jesus in the way that we follow him, to do that. But obviously it's not a criteria, of course, of any kind. There's no religious test to be in the program, but we also believe that that bringing that healing to our current reality is also a big part of what God has called us to do. So I think our mission is both and.
Right, but not the hard sell. It sounds like it's more a measured thing. I love that idea of bringing reconciliation and wholeness to a broken world, you know, and broken people. You know, that is very ennobling, isn't it? Rather than foisting our viewpoint on somebody. I think that's that, you know, we teach more faithfully by example, right, than we do by dictate, you know. Yeah. By their fruits you shall know them, right? You know, yeah. and if our fruits are right, if what we do is yielding the fruit, then, you know, people can see that, right? And give glory to the one who, you know, inspired that. So I think it's a different shift. It's a slightly different shift.
Attitude, you know. And one of the biggest things that I think affirms that we're on the right track here is that in places like Dar es Salaam, Mombasa, we have almost equal participants who would identify as a Christian versus a Muslim. And I think if our program was in any way just making people feel really uncomfortable because we were pushing a spiritual agenda so hard, I just don't think we'd be able to see so many Muslims coming into a Christian church and feeling very much at home there for right. Your long program. So I've been encouraged by that.
Yeah, that's good. So when you were younger, obviously your dad was a mentor, and you mentioned quite a few times in the book that, you know, the advice he gave you and some of his little words of little sayings and quotes from the Bible. Is he still doing that for you? You still getting your some help from him and some words of wisdom?
Yes, absolutely, all the time. My dad is one of my heroes and has been really studying leadership very intently for the past 25 years. And so there is, you know, in terms of just organizational leadership, there's very few people on this planet that knows as much as he does. And I just get to sit under that and benefit from that, which has been incredible. And his big focus in all of his stuff, whether he's writing about personal growth or building a team or, you know, whatever it may be, it's all geared around this idea of servant leadership. And, that word has sometimes lost its power, and maybe it's been taken advantage of in certain ways, but the idea of that is really core to my leadership philosophy. I mean, it's why Care for AIDS exists, is for me and Cornell and Duncan to serve our people so that they can serve our clients. And then that's really what we've taken from the example of Jesus Christ.
Right, exactly. It's interesting because I serve on the board of Unity World Headquarters, and one of our lines is true leaders have a servant heart, you know, which is very thing we're talking about, that the, I love what you say about humility, you know, that some people, of course, who don't really take it in its deepest sense, think that humility is some kind of weakness, or can be, but really, or it's meek or something, you know, it's not strong. But really, true humility is incredibly strong, right? Because, you know, you've given up your small sense of self for this larger Christ sense of who works through you. And there can be nothing more powerful than that, right? But then it becomes a joy to humble oneself, it seems to me, you know, because you swapped out something small for something incredibly powerful and life-changing. So, you know, who would not want to do that, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's so true.
So let's talk a bit in the remains of the show. Looking forward, what's going to unfold both for you personally and for the organization, you know, Care for AIDS? Tell us about that. And, you know, what's the next 5 years going to show us?
Yeah, well, we didn't talk about this, but I have my wife and I have a 5-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 10-week-old. So
congratulations on the new one, especially.
Thank you. So the next 5 years are going to be very interesting on the personal front for sure.
Yeah, of course.
But on the organizational front, you know, we have, I mean, grand visions for what we think God could do through Care for AIDS. We are always submitted to obviously his plans and his desires for us, but he gave us a vision a couple years ago that by the end of 2027, that we would have empowered 100,000 individuals.
Wow.
Who were and families affected by HIV and AIDS. And today we're right at about 17,000. And that number, 100,000, that holds a lot for us because that represents, you know, 300,000, give or take, children of those families. It probably represents about 300 of the most highly affected communities in Eastern and Southern Africa. And to see the churches in those 300 communities rise up and address maybe the most pressing social issue of their time, I think can just change the whole narrative of HIV and redeem the church's position as a leader in the community when it comes to these issues. And so I think for us, that's where we want to go. We will continue to evolve and pivot as the HIV epidemic evolves. But at the end of the day, if we're still driving towards how to empower people to live a life beyond AIDS, that's going to be, you know, that's our, that's kind of our due north. So we'll keep pursuing that. And this new innovation into rural areas is kind of a new frontier for us, but if we're one of the few faith-based organizations that is tackling this, we want to be able to go into these places to help address this need outside of just the urban context. Because in rural areas, there are a lot of people that don't have access to good services. Stigma is really, really high. So we're not sure to what extent we'll continue to push into rural versus urban, but that's something that we'll be working on in the next few years, and hopefully developing new innovation as well into some technology, as every person in East Africa now has a phone, and a lot of them have smartphones now. So mm-hmm. Finding ways to innovate how we help people with HIV manage their care through their smartphone, so that we can hopefully have a greater impact that way as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, your book is called Beyond Blood, and I can, you know, imagine different meanings for that title. But I want to hear it from you. You know, what do you mean by Beyond Blood?
Well, you know, so Beyond gives a little bit of a nod to our mission statement, which is, you know, life beyond AIDS. Right. And obviously blood, the word blood alludes to obviously the HIV piece of our work. But, you know, at the deeper level, which we've talked about a little bit, is that there is a redemptive relationship that took place between Cornell, Duncan, and myself. All three of us have nothing in common. We don't come from the same bloodline, if you will, or race.
Right.
We also come from different backgrounds and socioeconomic statuses. And so for us, the power of Care for AIDS is that we were unified through our common faith, and we were able to transcend those lines that have been drawn and borders, if you will, and we were able to create something that was better and more redemptive for that. And I think that's hopefully the message that people will take in our current state here in the U.S. and in the church as we try to find unity amidst our diversity.
Right, exactly. Well put. And, you know, unfortunately, we live in the, you know, in a society now, and in fact, a world that sort of is reacting against globalism, right? And we're going back to our tribe, you know, our tribalism. There's a strong desire to, you know, make America great again, whatever that means, you know, in terms of, for some people, it means, you know, making it all white again, you know, before it became, you know, diversified culture. And so, you know, that may not all be wrong, but on the other hand, it may not all be right. You know, there's problems with that. And it's a sort of a silo mentality, isn't it? You know, my tribe is better than yours. And if we're going to push the world forward, it seems to me we can't live in those silos anymore. You know, we have to come together. And I think the book is testimony to that. And that's what I like about the book is, because you've got these diverse tribal, you know, affiliations from the two people from Kenya, but then, you know, you as a Westerner are very different from them, and yet you came together, like you said, you know, with a shared focus and faith, you know, to do some work together. And it seems that we need more of this in our world, you know, not the silo, right? Are you optimistic about, you know, not just HIV/AIDS, but you're optimistic about where people my age, the baby boomers, have left you all as millennials? You know, are you happy? Did we do okay? Or did we really screw it up? I mean, what do you think?
Well, I'm, you know, the millennials are an interesting generation because we've diverged from one another. There's the old millennials and the young millennials. So
right, that's true.
Sometimes we look down at our younger counterparts who we think might give us a bad name. But, you know, I mean, I think from where I sit from a faith perspective, I mean, I hope to always maintain an optimism about where the world is going. I mean, it's hard sometimes to look at the things that are around us, but even in the microcosms of the communities that I work in East Africa, I see hope and optimism, and I see a ton of people that are in my generation who are that are trying to change our society and our culture for the better, and who are bringing a new approach and wave to faith that is a more appropriate, I think, response to dealing with the earthly and the eternal, and working towards more justice overall in our world today. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that could get you discouraged if you look too far, but I think there are a lot of things that are optimistic about, and I think God is still at work. And ultimately, I believe at the end of the day, you know, this world is going to eventually be restored, but who knows the time when that'll happen.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, very good. Okay, so I like to ask sometimes what people's favorite scriptures are, that sort of a guide. And I know you mentioned a few in the book, but is there one or two that really they're it for you? That's your guiding principle that gets you through a day.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a couple that I love. In the book, I think I talk about one that my dad just always preached to me was. Colossians 3:23 is whatever you do, work out of all your heart is working for the Lord and not for man. And I think he instilled in me a great sense of stewardship in my life, that what I've been entrusted to is, I've got limited time and resources, and God's given me certain abilities. And so I think that has been a big driving factor for me. Since the beginning of Care for AIDS, I really early on discovered this passage in James chapter 2, verses 16 and 17. It says, if one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and well fed, but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? In the same way, faith by itself, if not accompanied by action, is dead. And I think that as I live out this work in East Africa, and I think about the posture of the church towards people with HIV, was just a lot of go, be warm and well fed. There just wasn't a lot of there. And so I've continued. That's been a guiding verse for me, as we say, that our response has to be both physical and spiritual, and we can't forget that.
Yeah, excellent. And, you know, James isn't always lifted up. Sometimes, he's contrasted to Pauline, theology or whatever, which is justification by faith and all that. But I think there's room for that, the balance there, right? We have to put feet on our prayers, and move and do something. So I think that's hugely important. Again, coming back to our, great Master Jesus. I mean, he was the one that didn't just talk about it, right? He actually did the work, and went in the places where nobody else wanted to go, and put himself at risk often, and to demonstrate that. And so, if we're going to follow, we need to follow the full gospel, right? Which involves the physical work. So, yeah, I commend you for your willingness to do that. I'm also excited that I've got somebody like you on the show today, because our denomination is more, we could say it's kind of, some people would say we're way out there in, left field or whatever. I don't see it like that. I think we speak some truth also, as all denominations do, but it's, often we don't want to talk to evangelicals or whatever, because we feel like, they don't understand this or whatever. But I think it's great when we can come together and have a very adult conversation, which is what we've had today. That's nuanced. It's not just the black or white, because we all have to get along. We have to live in this world. So that's exciting for me. So I'm glad you were, willing and able to be on this show, and also on our network, because that's part of the healing, as far as I'm concerned. So that's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, if you got one thing to say, we got a minute left. If we've got one thing to say to encourage somebody that's listening, maybe somebody that's wanting to do something to make a difference, what would you say? Somebody's down right now.
Well, this whole episode today is talking about, finding that meaning. And I would just encourage you, wherever you are, whether you are in Africa or not, there are somebody in your context that is struggling. And I think part of finding our meaning is reaching out and giving our life for others. And when it's all about us, I think that's when things really start to lose that meaning. But when we see our life as an opportunity to spend it on behalf of others, I think that's when we'll start to see the true meaning there. So wherever you are, I think whether you're feeling down or not, I think there may be an opportunity for people who are either unlike you in some way, or maybe they're marginalized in some way because of their circumstances. And I think if we can take a step towards those groups of people, I think it will actually help us in discovering our own meaning.
Wonderful. We're at the end of the show, folks. Let me tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye to Justin. Next week, Drusilla French joins me. She's a professor and author. She's going to talk about the wheel of the year, the patterns of the flow and season that can deepen our understanding and meaning in our lives. So join me then. But right now, I want to say thank you so much to Justin for being on the show today. What a wonderful show.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world. We'll be right back.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.